Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am very honored to have the wonderful Robin Lane Fox. Robin is a historian and emeritus fellow of New College, Oxford, and has taught ancient history at Oxford University from 1977 to 2014. He's taught on Greek and Latin literature and Islamic history for many years, and he has written many books on classical history, including his most recent book, Homer and His Iliad, which is what we talk about in the conversation. We start by talking about how to best read the Iliad. He gives his pitch for why people should read it in the original Homeric Greek, which I thought was really interesting. We talk about the structure of the poem, the use of speeches, language, and movement. We talk about the location of Troy, Homer's authorship, Homer's description of the Trojan War, Homer's illiteracy, the Iliad's transcription, the genius of Homer, and many more topics. I was really, really honored to talk with Robin. He's a giant in the field. He has absolutely done so much work within various forms of literature and specifically with Homer. So I was very, very happy with the conversation. He's a delightful person and obviously just a wealth of knowledge. As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube, so get over there, subscribe, follow, share with your friends, contribute. And now I bring you Robin Lane Fox. I am here with Robin Lane Fox. Robin, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. Great pleasure.
Absolutely. You've written a marvelous book. It's called Homer and His Iliad. Of course, people will have know who Homer is and have hopefully read the Iliad at some point. So it's absolutely fantastic. Before we get into the book, why don't you just tell listeners just a snapshot of who you are academically, professionally, and what you're currently up to?
Well, I'm a split personality. I have two main lives, and I'm the same person. My main life today is that I have taught ancient history, Greek and Latin, and even some Arabic for up to 50 years. Wow. 50 years ago, I began teaching Homer's Iliad, and then I became a teacher of ancient history, not the Iliad so much, always in Oxford University. Where better in the world? Come on, you know. It's my home. I can't imagine anywhere else. I always say I've been a long way in life. I went all the way from one corner of Oxford, Magdalen College as an undergraduate, beautiful with a park and gardens and everything, right up the other end of Oxford, very different world. Mm. Not so rich, the college, Worcester College, beautiful garden. And then I came to rest in New College, Oxford, where I taught for 40 years. Wow. But my second life is I've been a gardener all my life. Hmm. When I left school, I went straight to work in a botanical garden before I came up as an undergraduate. I love gardening from the age of 10. And I think I held a record in the world. One, anyway, at least. You probably held more. I have written a gardening column weekly for the big Financial Times newspaper. Every wow. week for nearly 54 years.
Wow.
How about that?
Wow. Wow, that's very, very impressive. That kind of a consistency is, you can't find that nowadays.
Yeah, you don't really, but you see, I write about what I'm doing because I'm always gardening. And the wonderful thing about Oxford jobs, quite unlike Princeton or concrete at Harvard, mm-hmm. is that you are in charge of a garden around your college. So as well as my own garden, I'm looking after about 9 acres of garden. And I would say very firmly, it would be universally agreed by all people of sound sense, we are far the best college garden in Oxford. So we really want to see. I think that isn't even controversial.
Right. Those are the bragging rights there. That's good. That's good. Wow. That's really, really nice. So I mean, I guess, you've been talking and writing and teaching about the Iliad for, half a century, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, when I was preparing for our conversation, I reread the Iliad.
Oh, good.
So it's kind of in my head.
So this is the first one I did in English. The classic Robert Fagles, Iliads or Penguin classics. That's not the one I read this time. This time, I read the new one by Emily Wilson.
Yeah.
It's a new one that's out. Really good. It's really, really good. I know she was talking about it. Some people were, you know, whining and complaining about some things, and other people really loved it. So, which is really interesting. I guess the first question I have, since you've been doing this so long, is with this book, with the Homer and his Iliad, when you're close to something for a long time, I'm assuming you're still learning things. What is it that you learned from in writing this book that you was like, oh, I haven't seen that before. I never thought of it that way. Or, you know, 20 years ago, I thought about it this way, but now I see that. What were some things that you kind of just popped out to you?
Ah, what a good question. People start books, they never admit why. Zadie Smith, the novelist, wrote a good essay saying that writing books was something to do. People never own up to that. So I will own up. I agreed to write what I thought would be a short book on Homer in order to pay my electricity bill. but then I was taught a very sharp lesson. I think anyone who's written a book will know. I thought, look, I know this thing so well. I'll just go back to it. I'll do it in 3 months. I went back to the Iliad slightly anxious that it would, you know, might slightly fail to live up to my happy memories and intense knowledge of it. And of course, I just saw so much that I'd never seen before. And it took me, instead of 3 months, it took me 3 years.
At every turn,
I find new things. I was teaching it very kindly. I was invited to by the undergraduates here. Only a week ago, I was teaching Book 18, the famous scenes of Achilles' shield. And I noticed things I had never noticed before in Book 8, or I'd noticed but never really thought about. I think I would say I had translated but never thought about. And my first overriding message from the heart is, whatever you may think of the poem, you may be mistaken and prefer the Odyssey. Homer is a genius. Mm-hmm. And the more you look, the more you can hardly imagine the skill that has gone into the poem. And it's a wonderful feeling. Throughout my life, I felt that.
Mm. Yeah, that's just really, really nice to hear. It's kind of it's nice in one sense, and then it's, you know, kind of daunting in another sense. It's like, wow, if somebody has looked at it for a long time, you know, and I've read it, you know, 3 or 4 times, it's like, wow, there's so much you can come back to and just get so many things. It's like a bottomless well of sorts of information in a way. So I guess the first question I have here is, you know, people have heard of it, you know, maybe people have seen film adaptations or whatever. Hopefully people have read it. If someone hasn't, I guess, what would be the kind of initial approach to the Iliad? If you've never read it, do you just sit down and you read it, you know, in a couple sittings, you take your time with it? How do you, for that listener that's never really sat down with it, why should they, and what's a good way of going about doing that?
Right. Well, I think there are two questions here. It depends what you mean by reading the Iliad. Uh-huh. We sat down as schoolboys to read the Iliad. You would have been expelled from Eton College if you were found to have a translation. That was the real crime. You were not allowed to. And so we had to study it in Greek. Mm. And when I came to Oxford, we read the whole thing through in Greek. Mm. A lot of attention, a lot of money has been spent on me since the age of 13. And I don't need, thank God, Fagles or even Emily Wilson, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. I read Homer straight off. Mm-hmm. And I would simply say, remember that all of us, including those who, thousands of us who love the poem, just began with no knowledge of it. And we began in book one and we read forwards. Mm. Okay, but then... it's the modern world. And I do realize that I think it takes 2 years to be able to master Homeric Greek. Yeah. Buy a Homeric dictionary and damn well do it. Mm. But many of your listeners either have done it or are not going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think I would say I would get 2 translations. I would get Richmond Latimore, not Fagles. I don't think this is my personal idiosyncratic choice. I think most people who teach the poem would say they still think Latimore has got a poetic flow to it. And I would get the Penguin prose new-ish translation by Martin Hammond. And that will give you a sense of the plot. Martin is a great expert in Greek. There are no mistakes in it. And that's a very good thing. And then I don't think you can do worse, or other odd advice, than to start with book one. I mean, book one is one of the miracles of the human mind.
Yes.
If you want my top 10, I don't really like giving them because the poem interrelates all the way through. Mm-hmm. I would say this, read one, skim through two, of course, read three, read six, mm-hmm. amazing, read mm-hmm. nine, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. 10, I think, like almost every scholar thinks, is an addition into whatever you think the original Iliad was. So you needn't worry too much about that one. It's interesting in its own right. And I think 11 to 13 can be, for outsiders at first, a bit of a grind because there is so much fighting.
Yeah.
When you look closely, they're marvelous. Then you read book 14 with just unparalleled Hera's decision to seduce Zeus and send him to sleep after sex so that she can then once more favor the Greeks. Zeus has been favoring the Trojans. And it's so brilliant. She sees Zeus sitting on his mountain peak, and he was hateful to her in her heart. She loathed him, but she was still going to go through with it because it was essential to get her way favoring the Greeks. And then you would read book 16, the tremendous scenes to and fro leading to the death of Patroclus. Mm. You read 18, the shield of Achilles in particular. I mean, what can one say? One of the miracles of many miracles in the poem. And then you simply read the last three. And if you are unchanged by 22, 23, and 24, then you are a woman or a man of flint. There's something wrong with you. And even in translation, to have read those books and thought about them is something that changes you forever. So that's what I would do. That's my background. That's my top 10. But I mean, the most important thing is just find a Greek teacher and get on with it. Look, it's not impossible. It's not nearly probably as difficult as learning Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And it's such fun. The most extraordinary thing I've seen in my lifetime, this move away terror of teachers to teach languages. But people love languages when they're little. It's terrific fun getting things right and being able to communicate. Mm-hmm. And then you really are in a very strong position because then when you've got the Greek, you'll get better and better as you read through. Start at book one and end at book 24. Bingo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I firmly agree with you about the Greek. In another life, I attended a seminary and we had to learn different languages. And so we Koine Greek and then we learned Hebrew.
Excellent.
I don't use it too much anymore, but and obviously Homeric Greek is a little bit different than Koine Greek, but still, it is really, really nice to read things in their original language. And I actually quite like Greek. Greek is it makes a lot of logical sense, and so it's very nice. I haven't read the Iliad in Greek, but
I love your way, your throwaway thing of saying I rather love Greek. I'll tell you firmly, there are three great languages in the world: Greek, English, and Arabic. With long poetic traditions. I mean, you know, some of your listeners know Spanish. I'm so sorry. You know, there's a certain golden age to read, not anything else much. And it hasn't got wonderful flexibility, but I'd just like to emphasize one thing. Mm-hmm. Get a Homeric dictionary because that limits the words only to the words in Homer. So much easier to use.
It's nice.
And secondly, first time through, don't worry about every word. Look, the words, I still don't know what they mean. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows. I know all the alternative views of them, but that doesn't really help. Mm-hmm. Kick on, go forwards. And the faster you go forwards, you'll suddenly find you two are galloping. And that is a great moment in life. Look, you know, it happened to us as boys when we were 16. For heaven's sakes, we had a lot else on our minds, including sport every day and God knows how many other subjects. Mm-hmm. But we were seized by it.
Mm. Yeah. So, but I want to talk about the first book a little bit, as you were mentioning, it's an absolute masterpiece that in itself, but I want to talk about, I guess, the structure of the poem. So there's these 24 books and it's been made a kind of a thought that it is after the alphabet, the alpha to omega aspect. Could you talk about, I guess, the structure of the book with these 24 and the connection with the alphabet?
Yeah, I will. The most important thing to say is that I think everybody's view is that the book numbers are later than the composing poet or poets. Mm-hmm. So we put books 1 to 24, alpha to omega letters. Mm-hmm. When that began is disputed. A minority think it may have begun in the late 6th century BC. I don't think so. I side with the majority that is 500 years after Homer. Mm. So it's not integral to the way the performer and the poet, for me, composing in performance, saw the poem. That's important. What is interesting and much studied is the belief that the poem describes a ring. It goes round from a particular cluster of themes and it ends with them again in reverse. Mm. This is all very clever. And I give, 10 out of 10 to the people who've seen this. I'm not wholly persuaded it's right. Thetis goes up to heaven to plead with Zeus. Thetis comes down from heaven again to plead with Achilles. Mm-hmm. A body is ransomed and given back in book 24, whereas the body of a slave girl has been taken away in book 1, and so it goes on. You might say there are similar themes that come round, but I don't see a very tight ring. There are people who do. So I think that is the most interesting approach to the shape of the poem. Do you believe in a ring composition? That means you circle all the way around, and then you come back, often in alternative sequence, to the themes with which you began. Hmm. That is not impossible, especially for those like me who thinks Homer couldn't read or write. I'll come on mm-hmm. to that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think that's the best first thing to say about the structure. Then the book division is arbitrary. And I would urge people who are reading it to try ignoring it. It's fun. You read book 2 into book 3, or you read book 5 into book 6. That's been put on by later scholars. It's great convenience. We can now refer to the poem as book 18, line 231. But Homer wouldn't have a clue what we were talking about.
It's very interesting. So parachute us into book 1.
Right.
Give us a picture of what Homer does here and really what we see throughout the whole of the poem. We have speeches, we have scenes with the gods, scenes with men. Yep. He's showing us this art and intricacy of the story. Kind of just walk us through some of these major themes in the Iliad.
You've done rather well, actually, starting off. One point I want to stress, which has been only stressed more recently in scholarship, the Iliad is a poem very dense in speeches. Mm-hmm. They haven't invented rhetoric, the formal analysis of speech with technical terms for the way we deliver our speeches, but my God, they can speak already. Mm-hmm. And that's all straight up front in book 1. I think something like 60% of book 1 is speech. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are four amazing things about book 1. There are 140 amazing things about book 1, but here are some. Mm-hmm. The speed with which the poet goes bang straight into the story. Wallop. Yep. Poem is about the wrath, the manis. All respect to Emily Wilson, cataclysmic wrath is a cataclysmic mistake, Emily. That's not the right word. wrath, sing of the wrath of, O goddess, of Achilles, son of Peleus. Then how was it that the wrath began and what set Agamemnon and Achilles against one another? And within 10 lines, you're straight into it with such force and power, brilliant conveying of what you need. To know. And you look at other epics in the world, even Paradise Lost or the Aeneid, you're messing around for 20, 30, often more verses. Yeah. So Homer was rightly praised for going straight in to the middle of things. Would God the journalists on my newspaper, the Financial Times, remember to do this? You read their columns and you get the first entire column, let alone something far too long in the New Yorker. Well, they're still grinding on, and they haven't got to the point till page 2. So they also be subjected to a course in the Iliad. That's the first thing. Hmm. Secondly, there is a wonderful contrast between the world of men and the world of the gods, but very illuminating. Hmm. We see a bitter quarrel break out on Earth, which is irreconcilable. Insults fly. Achilles loses and taken away from him ridiculously. The prize he had been really almost voted, not by Agamemnon, the leader of the Greeks, but by the entire Greek people. I'll come back to that. And in heaven, we see a quarrel about to begin between Zeus and Hera. One of the great things about Homer, he has no starry-eyed view of a marriage made in heaven. Nobody has ever bickered more, not even a married couple in the middle of New York, than Hera and Zeus. It's wonderful. But it's patched over. And instead, they listen to the divine music of Apollo and the Muses singing Antiphony with their fair voices. And Zeus goes to bed, and golden-throned Hera climbs into bed and goes to bed with him too. All is settled in heaven, because it always is. The gods live at ease. They can be activated briefly by their hatred or their love or their lust for mortals. But in the end, they live in a trouble-free zone. Very, very powerful. I don't think at all that this is just a poetic creation. This is fundamental to Greek views of the gods. I'll come on to that later. So you have this wonderful parallel of two different quarrels developing in two different ways. That, again, really important. And then, completely amazingly, who is the most inadequate, complete no-hoper, really, you know, beyond any of the recent British prime ministers in the beginning of Iliad but one? It's Agamemnon. I mean, he completely hasn't got a leg to stand on. He takes away the prize of his greatest warrior. He loses his temper, and he's completely inept. Well, just think for a moment. What an amazing way to start a poem on a heroic theme. The Tale of Troy is all well known. Homer has selected this part, the wrath of Achilles, and he's going to tell it in a compressed time pattern. People work out it's only 50 days of action. But I think even more importantly, there are only 4 days of fighting. Most of it happens within a week. This is an incredible decision. And then he begins not with, you know, the all-conquering hero, like all heroes we read about, the Manas in Central Asia, or all these people. We read about a man who's completely inept, though he's leader of the expedition. Now, Homer isn't making a point about the abstract iniquities of kingship. This is an important thing. People have gone wrong. There is no political theory in Homer's era. That's a creation in the Greek world of the 440s BC. What he's saying is that sometimes, as we all know, kings are hopeless and they get things wrong. That's not an argument for not having a king. It's not political at all in that sense. But what a striking presentation. So the audience would have been amazed by that. And then I would say it's the very fast-moving speeches and the brilliant pacing of the book. I'll give you just two touches of what I dwell on. I have a chapter on this. I was very struck by how the first book of the Iliad is an example of a famous philosophical approach to language, named by the iconic philosopher of the 1950s, Austin, J.L. Austin, How to Do Things with Words. And Austin made a world-famous reputation for showing how we can promise or we threaten or we can inaugurate using sentences, whereas logicians always tend to think they're descriptive. So much of the Iliad is doing things with words. It's not just about a custer and an exchange of speeches. People promise Zeus. People threaten. They sing or whatever. This is part of the ingrown movement. Homer understands the practical dynamism of speech. And I would like to say I think nobody's ever quite looked at it as I did in that way. And that explains why you're pitched straight in and you're swept along. Things are happening the whole time, though they're happening through speeches. But then there are the passages where it goes slower. Beautiful passages. The famous ones are always, of course, cutting up meat and offering it to hospitality. You hear, and they put it on skewers and they laid it on the fire and so on and so forth. That's traditional. But also putting a ship to sea. The book is brilliantly paced. So, speeches. The contrast between the world of the gods and the world of humans, starting a poem with the ineptitude of the president. I mean, he really is, you know, beyond belief, Agamemnon. I mean, they might well elect him next year. I think it's quite possible if he ran as a candidate. I think he might well win. It would be appalling. If I see Agamemnon standing in 2024, I will take American citizenship and stand against him, I guess. It's not possible. I know you haven't got very good options anyway yet. Somebody may emerge. That's all immensely important. How to do things with words, and also how to pace a book, and then round off what to us is a book with this wonderful scene of peace restored in heaven, where Apollo and the Muses, think of it, I wish I could hear them, are singing at as the gods feast and drink. Everything could have disrupted them has been laid aside. They're singing with their fair voices, antiphonally. And then Zeus goes to his hall and climbs into bed, and beside him, Hera, with whom he nearly had had a quarrel. You know, it's a marvelous movement. What can I say?
Yeah. No, you give a lot of the themes, and it's those elements that we see throughout the poem. There's one thing you mentioned about speeches I wanted to kind of just tack on here is, you say how we talk about how speeches are important, but also that they tend to be preceded by movement. So you're talking again about this, like doing things with words and pacing. Yeah, can you talk about that movement piece with speeches?
Yeah, exactly. There's been a bit more study of it, even as I was writing. The poem is also how to do things with words. It's not just people threatening one another. Many different things come about because of what is said. But also the characters are moving into position. There's a dynamism going on. My advice to everybody, and I think people in America have a particular advantage, try to picture this as if it's a film unfolding. Because one of the things I came to feel more and more is that Homer has a sort of pre-filmic imagination. He knows how to cut away, to do a long shot, a close shot, how to interweave and cut in battle scenes. And again, try to visualize what he's presenting. And you see these people standing forwards in a haste and throwing their scepter on the ground, and then they speak. There's a relation between speech and movement. Thank you very much for noticing that. So what's the point I'm trying to get across? That this poem is so dynamic, and it has an amazing gift, which I, at the moment, am rather lacking on this broadcast, the saying of everything in a very few words. I would contrast it with poems people, you know, greatly admire. I can see why people like the Mesopotamian epic of Gilgamesh. But, you know, the Gilgamesh poem will never use one line when 10 might do. And he goes into endless refrains, and everything is spelt out ad infinitum. Obviously, it's an admirable poem, an amazing poem, and we're finding more of it, but it's not in any way Homer. But Homer can put it in three words. And the fires of the dead were burning densely. That's all he says for the scale of the pandemic. He didn't think it was a pandemic, of course. And that's also part of the movement, the speed, the propulsion of the poem. So strong.
Yeah, no, that's great. So let's talk about a little bit of the context. So Troy, where is Troy? Is it a real place? Is it, you know, what is the ideas? You give a bunch of ideas there about people debating the location. And then more generally, you know, I mean, the Aegean Sea is an interesting place. Anytime I read these things or things from history, I try to kind of take off in my head. I mean, I'll kind of reference it of sorts, but I'll take off like these nation states we create. And really it's regional, right? So the Aegean Sea is, you know, if you have, you know, West Turkey kind of outside Istanbul on the other side of the sea with, you know, Thessalonica and Athens, like that's a whole region. You have the Anatolia region. Oh. Obviously you have the Hittites as well. So just talk about contextually this region and where Troy might be.
Well, I'm going to apologize first. And I just ask you to forgive exhaustion. For some reason, I failed to print a map in the book. And I'm actually very sorry about it because I know the area so well. I did think of it. I just thought I'm too tired. I'm so sorry. This has been done partly in lockdown. I will do it for the paperback.
Oh, okay.
Troy, Northwest Asia Minor. Right. There were much discussion in the up until the 19th century where the exact site of Troy was. And people made a slight mistake and put it slightly in the wrong place, Buonabashi. But actually, and Schliemann, the famous German excavator, proved that the city of a major city, which has to be Troy, I'll come on to that, lies at Hissarlik, the site known as the fortification. And Schliemann went at it like a sort of bull in a china shop, and of course professional archaeologists now profess to loathe him. Mm. Look, I can't loathe Schliemann. I mean, he had a massive team of workers, and he went straight through about nine levels that should have been kept separate. But he found the damn thing. I'm not sure we wouldn't still be looking for it without him. Mm. And a lot of it he didn't damage. Now, the second thing is, can we be sure that the name Ilion, which is the main name of Troy in the poem, is an old name? It could just be Homer's invention. I mean, I loathe Tolkien. At this point, most of your readers will turn off. But, you know, I can't do The Lord of the Rings. I can't remember what the place is meant to be called. Mm-hmm. But it's plainly a fiction. Of course, it's been an enormous success worldwide. Homer might have invented somewhere called Ilion. But we now know beyond doubt that he didn't. Mm. Various little pieces have come together since really 1997-8 to show the quite independent geography of Asia Minor, in the broadest sense of geography, for the ruling Hittite powers. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that the place they called Wilusa, with a word before the I, just as the Greek originally had been called Wylion, Wilusa stood in the area where Troy has to be. Mm. So there's a real prehistory of a name for the site that Schliemann executed. Excavated. Mm-hmm. Could say executed, actually, be quite accurate. And we are absolutely certain where Troy is, and we are now certain that it was called Wilusa. I mean, obviously, occasional voices arranged in protest, but there's no doubt about it. If you know the Hittite place names available. Mm-hmm. So we know at once that there is a much older pattern and tradition here behind Homer. There's no question of Homer being the first poet to sing about the Trojan War. No. When he introduces people like Patroclus, very striking, Achilles' great friend, you know, the man he most loves in the broad sense of the world. He doesn't have to present him by his first name. He calls him the son of Menoetius, because everybody knows already who he is, for instance. But what Homer is doing is he's pitching into an enormous, long, straggling great series of stories, sort of, you know, the Harry Potter saga gone mad. And he's picked on the central emotion and its consequences, the wrath, the loss, the revenge, and the pity that is involved. And that is, you know, I think, is new. Mm. And behind it is a whole place names for Troy. Indeed, I do emphasize this in the book. I might just elaborate. A grasp of what we call the Troad, the surrounding country. Now, there are two things here. American scholar Jenny Strauss Clay recently made a very good observation that the poet naturally sees the battlefield and the war from the Greek camp outwards. There is a consistent point of view for the poet implicit throughout the poem. So hang on to that. That's one. But secondly, people have argued from time to time that so precise is Homer's grasp of individual features in this landscape that he must have been there himself. Mm-hmm. This was a view memorably espoused in the early 19th century by an English visitor, Kinglake, who suddenly realized a technical thing, that you could see the island of Samothrace far off, despite Lembros and Scaros, if you're standing on the site of Troy. Now, it's not just that impresses me, because you could say that these places had their names subsequently in honor of the Iliad people fixed names as they do for sites in the Odyssey. I could elaborate that. What impresses me is that Homer has a grasp of the interrelationship of some of these places. Mm. And he has a sense of the distance between them and the views from them. Of course, he's got no map. And in Homer, for me and for some, I hope as a result of the book more, Homer cannot write. He can't read. But he's got a sort of vague spatial sense in his head. And yet he can hold consistently to the interrelationship of places in the landscape around Troy, where we can fix their names. They fit perfectly the distribution of space he often gives, not always, because he hasn't got a map. Mm-hmm. And I think something is also very relevant here. The point of view is consistent, as Jenny Clay showed, but also, as others have hinted, and I think I elaborate more than most people before, the interrelationship of place is consistent throughout the poem. Now, very influential, excellent scholars, particularly in Harvard, the heirs to the oral studies of other poets by Milman Parry and so on, we'll come on to that, argue that there was a developing sequence of poets, and the Iliad grew like a snowball with different people over 250 years, maybe, adding bits to it. My book has a brief riposte to that, and it's as follows. Nonsense. And I hope that I carry people with me. The consistent point of view, only recently well brought out by Jenny Stryce Clay, the consistent grasp of space with no map for generations to help each other. Are we to imagine that poet upon poet went off for a summer vacation from Harvard and walked around in the Troad getting the sense of space exactly as Homer did? No, of course we aren't. There isn't a sort of Trojan pilgrimage for every poet who is meant to have contributed to this tradition. It's consistent because it's one man's poem based on what he had seen. And I give a great deal of weight to that. By any means, my only argument. So, yes, we found the site of Troy. Yes, we now know for certain an idea suggested in the early 20th century that it was called Willosa. Yes, we can be clear about Homer's grasp, not just of the city, but of surrounding terrain in many cases. Obviously, sometimes our cold water springs go nearer the city than they are. And of course, he hasn't got a map in front of him as he's composing. And this is all important. But what we cannot say is that we have definitive evidence that a mass campaign led by the totally inept Agamemnon sat for 10 years besieging the non-Greek city of Troy. We've got evidence of campaigns against Willosa. We've got evidence for Willosa in the 14th, 13th century BC. But we have not got the cardinal piece of evidence that would say a large Greek force in the heart of the Hittite Empire was besieging this place and eventually burned it. Now, there are one or two scholars, and they're very brave, and I respect them, who want, nonetheless, the Trojan War to be historical. I would have said the overwhelming majority is still against them. Perhaps one way to go, which I don't share, is that there was some such Greek raid by the people that the Hittites knew as the Ahiawa, the Achaeans, Homer's name for the Greeks, and that Homer has, in tradition before Homer, inflated it out of all recognition. But I go for a separate view, that the Trojan War was an invention built up to explain the great ruins of Troy, that the settlers, when they came back in the 11th, 10th century BC, Greek settlers in the area, they looked at these things and thought, what are they? And they said, oh, well, that's where our glorious ancestors sacked the city. And it all grew up from there. That would be my answer to it. There are slightly subtle variations with people, but I think I would say to watchers and listeners that the idea that the Trojan War is historical is regarded with considerable skepticism. Now, Of course, watchers will promptly think that it's probably right. All of you experts don't know. You can't know what will turn up. And that's wonderful. Something may turn up that proves it all. But I must say, I won't say I'm a Dutchman if it does. I will say I'll die of shock. It just isn't like that.
Yeah. So what do we know about Homer himself, right? We're talking about the context, Troy and the Trojan War, but what do we know about him himself? We can, if you want to mention it here, you can. I was going to bring it up later, but about the literacy thing, but what about him? Yeah. Where does he come from? And how did he come to write this poem and the motivations for writing it? So really about authorship here.
How kind of you to ask. I'm not prepared to be devoted to a genius, I mean, the genius, really, in world poetry, without having some idea that he existed. He was a man. I always say to people, really, to provoke them, do you think there was a Mrs. Homer? I would love to interview. Think of imagining interviewing Homer's wife, or maybe he had three or four of them, one after another, and they all couldn't put up with him. Fascinating to hear from them. This guy was a real person. Okay, if you belong to the Harvard School, there are about 30 real persons, but they are real people. And it's not controversial that there is a distribution of detailed knowledge of place, of seas, of views from particular sites down the west coast of what is now Turkey, Aegean Turkey. I think he'd been to Troy. I think everybody would agree that he knew some of the area a bit further south. Antiquity had a tradition. They had many different traditions about him because nobody knew. That he belongs in an area roughly between Izmir, Chios, that sort of area. But his topographic references to place names which are accurate, they're not in Homeric inventions. It's not some kind of Lord of the Rings bananas geography. We're not talking about the Kingdom of Narnia in the Narnia books. You can go there, you can buy a ticket, you can walk up and down the Homeric landscape. It's absolutely completely fascinating. People do that more, often mistakenly, for the Odyssey. Just draw a sharp contrast here. In Odysseus's absolutely wonderful tale of his exploits, he passes into Neverland, and he leaves the normal bounds of geography, and he meets Cyclopses and Laestrygonians and all these people. They're in a fantasy world. And of course, the poem was so successful that everybody living, particularly in the west of the Greek world, in Italy and Sicily, promptly tried to claim that they were the real place. No, you can't draw a map of Odysseus's journeys. Actually, what always interests me, people don't try to draw a map, including me. I'm so sorry, in the book, I did have one. It wasn't a very good one. Of the Iliad, it's as if it doesn't need one. It does. It's very exact. We don't know where he composed it because the language... This is a point relevant to all readers of Emily Wilson, and they must weigh this up for themselves. The one thing we know about Homeric language is that it is an artificial, not spoken poetic dialect. It's an amalgam which was never, ever spoken in one place. So in the so-called Dark Ages, which I believe are one of the great triumphs of human history, they actually produced Homer and loved him and listened to it. People turned up knowing they were going to hear something cast in language that was apart from their everyday communication. It was going to sound special. Now, I mean, obviously, Emily has probably thought carefully about this, but she is concerned to produce something she calls a translation for our times. And the choice she has made is, I think, misleadingly colloquial. You know, there is absolutely no way in, if I can use a rather silly analogy, in Homeric Greek that Hector, as he does in the Emiliad, says to the Trojans, get focused. That's a modern phrase. Do you see? There is nothing colloquial in Homer. There's nothing modern in Homer sustained over a period. So she took a deliberate decision, sure she thought about it, not to try to convey the solemn apartness of Homeric language. And obviously the poem has great flow and she's been very successful with the translation. But I think those who know Homer would say that's already killed it. And that's why I prefer, and others do, Latimer. He's got more of the solemnity. Now, this was a poetic dialect, so you can't say, because it blends forms in the East Greek world, particularly that Homer is composing there. He might have been a poet who trained there, and he's performing, let's say, Ridiculous View in Sicily or Spain. We don't know that. Mm-hmm. It's a language you use irrespective of place. Mm. But what we can say is his knowledge of place, quite detailed along the coastline, allows us to say that he was very familiar with it. Well, that's not much, is it? Then I have a second line of argument, which is wildly unpopular, but I'm certainly not giving one inch, and I encourage everybody else to do the same. Homer's similes. Okay, mm-hmm. These are the famous comparisons, as when a man talks too much on a Zoom broadcast and drives his audience mad, so tedious was the speech of Nestor to the Greeks or whatever. Now, Homer chooses these. The philologists have shown again and again that the language layers there are all what they call late. There's not an archaic tradition in many of them. I could elaborate, but I think the similes are all taken, understandably, from the audience's own period or a time very near them. Of course they are. They're meant to be making it clearer. If you read Milton, for instance, and you're living freezing cold in the middle of, I don't know where, Warwickshire in 17th century England, and you hear thick as the leaves strew the brooks in Vallombrosa, you haven't got a clue where Vallombrosa is, and it sounds sort of romantic. That's not the Homeric simile. The Homeric simile is always telling you things in your own, comparing things close to your own experience, so you can better appreciate a narrative that is set when men are not as they are nowadays. Now, if you look at the similes, which are Homer's choice, and they are individual in many cases, you can say, I think with certainty, that Homer himself had noticed these points of comparison. Okay, so you come closer to the poet in what's virtually an entire book, if you put them all end to end, then the simile is scattered right through most of the poem, than you do anywhere else. Well, I'll give a personal example, because, of course, everyone says, and I'm very honoured, but it's completely untrue, that I've tried to cast Homer as being like myself. I mean, that's idiotic. I can't write a line of poetry, and I'm not a genius in any way. But I do have certain interests in life, and Homer's awareness of certain features of trees, and particularly flowers and plants, very occasionally, is so precise. It's exact. It's not just imaginary. He's noticed the way that seed head of the head of a flower of a poppy will fall briefly sideways, like the dying head of Bergithia, in the most beautiful simile in Book 4. Mm-hmm. But that is a very particular thing to notice. I had to watch my poppies to be sure for a year in my British garden to see them doing it. Mm. And Homer had noticed it. Well, that didn't come from a tradition wrapped up and parceled down by Harvard University. That came from what he saw himself, and that's what he chose. Well, then I take it further, and of course everybody says, oh, come on, Robert, it's really sounding more and more like you, because the other thing I absolutely have loved in life, now banned in Britain, has been hunting. But Homer's descriptions, very different hunting, hunting a wild boar or lions on foot, is again very precisely, accurately too, observed and grounded. He's noticed things about the way lions pounce on their prey, the way they furrow their eyebrows, and the way they will stand on this, and the hound's reaction to it. This is not some distant survival from some bizarre past 500 years ago in the world of palaces, as many have said. There were lions in Asia Minor, we know from the bones that are found in Homer's time. So I come back to a further challenge to everybody. We can't know the answer, but you must remember there is one. What did Homer do all day? Okay, fine. He was a poet. He wasn't an aristocrat. He was obviously paid for and patronized by people. And he rehearsed a lot. But all over the world where we can study comparative oral poets in a very strong sense who compose orally, they have other lives. Of course they do. They're not just, you know, sort of specialists living in some academic department. Yeah. Very struck when I went into Kyrgyzstan with a G in Central Asia on horseback.
Oh, wow.
I came firmly up against the tales of the hero Manas and the amazing poems that are performed about Manas. So I got familiar with them. God, the performances are absolutely thrilling. They have no text at all, in no way. but the performers have a completely different life. I mean, one of the most famous ones kept golden eagles, and he would go out on horseback hunting when he wasn't performing this stuff. It's not a full-time career. You know, you're not in the front line on the Wall Street trading screen all day, and you can't, or in the middle of a hospital, and you can't take your eye off reality. Homer has to have done things. And in my view, because some of the observation is not traditional phrasing, he'd probably been on a lion hunt. Well, why not? Mm. There he was in a village, a bloody lion burst into the farm, and they chased it off with dogs, and Homer went out too. Young man, very exciting, never forgot it. Mm. So I do, with great care, use the similes to point to areas where Homer knows, and I ask you to think, how does he know from personal experience? Mm. Look, what I can't possibly say is, was he married? Did he fight with his wife? How many slaves did he keep? How many children, if any, did he have? You know, was he non-binary? I really don't know anything about him. I have no idea at all. Mm-hmm. But what I rebel against is the idea that he's some sort of entity later given a name and we don't know who he is. Because there is one genius working through the poem, making successive little revelations of how the story is going to go. Bit by bit, we learn more. Scattered right through it. You can't just cut them out and saying they were all put in by a later editor. They're integral to the passages. Then you have a consistency of use of similes and the range of them. Mm. Could I stress for viewers that I'm not saying that because Homer dwells on the preparation of meat, he therefore was a cook. I mean, this would be crazy. Right. And it's actually quite an interesting contrast. The passages where the heroes cut up a lamb or whatever and roast it on spits and so on, they're all patently traditional phrases that the poets had used for years. They give everybody a slowed down, a bit of a breather in the story. Mm-hmm. They're not Homer's own choice or creation. The things I am pointing to are linguistically idiosyncratic with an observation that is personal. How many of them are there? Depressingly few, from one point of view. But there's something. On the other side, I must say this. If we knew who Homer was, I wouldn't have written a book. And that was it. You could have pressed button B on Wikipedia and up came the answer. But what I love doing is reflecting on the possibilities and probabilities. Mm-hmm. So the big question, could he have been a woman? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I absolutely do not believe it. I think there is, how can I best put this? I think in the early period when I would date him, we have no comparable tradition that women compose long epic poems. So he would be very unusual. One, so unusual it would have been remembered. It isn't. Two, all the anecdotes assume that he's man. Okay, that's not decisive. Secondly, the understanding of combat, duel, fightings, and all of it is unusual. Even still in the American army with some very powerful women soldiers, I don't think they'd quite come up with this sort of poem. Mm-hmm. And I think you would have to say that it's mavericks like Robert Graves who think that Homer was a woman, and I think we really can exclude it. Well, I'm going to be more careful. We can strongly suspect he was not.
Sure.
But I mean, the wonderful thing, you know, that we must remember, the ancient world is a completely wonderful thing. It's as if there really is a muse of history who's deciding bit by bit to reveal a little bit more in everything she's taken away. So just to keep us on the edge of our seats, she lets out a new little bit we didn't know. Who knows what she's going to release in 2050? Mm-hmm. I mean, I may go to my grave if I ever die with somebody now knowing that Homer must have been a woman because we found an early inscription testifying it and signed by three people who we think really knew. I mean, even that wouldn't prove it. You can't ever rule anything out. That's part of the fun of ancient history.
Mm. Yeah. I want to, there's two questions and then I'll come back to some of the other pieces you were talking about. So you were talking about, we're talking about where Troy is. You're talking about where Homer was. We're talking about much of the region. And, you know, you mentioned Izmir, you mentioned the site of Troy, and all of these places are in modern day Turkey. And the question I was thinking of is, you know, we assign this with the Greeks, but a lot of this is taking place in Turkey, right? And again, I know historically this was all regional, so there weren't these nation states. Yeah. But I mean, how much do we think of it as, you know, it's very Greek, right? But a lot of this is in modern day Turkey. So, I mean, how do we think about this?
Actually, that's an even deeper question than possibly you realize, but everybody knows listening, of course, that the Turks only came to be in Asia Minor in the 11th century AD. There are no Turks there in antiquity, so Turkey as an entity didn't exist.
Right.
And what we know is that certainly from, well, let's be really, really perverse and say in the 10th century, I think that's too late, BC onwards, Greeks had settled settlements down that coast, all of which endured throughout antiquity for the next 600 years as Greek-speaking places. There have been earlier settlements. The place Miloanda must have been Miletus in 1350. So Homer's listeners, who will, I think, have been in this region, were entirely familiar with it being Greek. Mm. Where you touch on a question of even more profound interest is his vision of Trojans.
Okay.
Now, he refers to them as he refers separately to people called Phrygians. And we know from Oriental records, non-Greek records that are found in Asia Minor, that the Phrygians as a people only really came to group in this area in the 9th century BC onwards. So that is already a sign that Homer is composing long after the possible date of a Bronze Age Trojan War, which might have been otherwise about 1180 BC, some think. Mm-hmm. Now, how does he imagine the Trojans? Well, there's no reader who doesn't, I hope, and will always be reduced, as I am, to tears by the scenes inside Troy, the final parting of Hector and Andromache, the terrible fate of poor King Priam, and, I mean, obviously, transcendental, the return of dead Hector's body to Troy in 22, and then the completely amazing, death of Hector in book 22, and the return of Hector's body to Troy in book 24, which is, I think I would simply say, the supreme creation of the human mind. Mm. And I say that having lived for 77 years and seen, heard, and listened to many other supreme creations. So you can take me on that ground, but I'm not giving an inch. And that's why the Iliad is unsurpassably important.
Mm-hmm.
He is able to empathize. He sees the battle through their women. Contrast the Bible. You might try that. That's interesting. You know, God simply tells the arriving Israelites to slaughter the lot of them. Hivites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, kill the lot. Genocide begins with the orders of God in the book of Deuteronomy. Yep. There's no question of Zeus insisting on genocide. Mm-hmm. And also the victory songs, slightly different genre, of the conquering Israelite forces in the Bible. They're marvelous. They're wonderful. Song of Deborah and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But what do? They gloat at the thought that the women will be looking out of the windows saying, where are their chariots? Why are they late in coming? But they all lay dead, slaughtered by the Israelites. Mm-hmm. That's not on the same level as Homer's presentation of the impact of war and the reactions to war through the women's eyes and how influential that was. What are many of the great Greek tragedies? They see events through the eyes of the women, the Trojan women, by Euripides being one. Euripides is Andromache. Euripides is Helen. This is all in the wake of Homer, because on the whole, he presents Trojans who are far more like the Greeks than they ever would have been in real life. Now, I've given my life to studying the ancient Greeks. And one very striking thing about them is their first instinct is to incorporate complete foreigners into the, what's been well called the great Greek family of peoples, all related through mythical heroes. They make a very touching mistake. They think they're more like us than they really were. Mm. What a marvelous mistake. And I would then say something else. Mm. Homer is thought, certainly by me, to be on the end of the Dark Ages. Mm. Right. It's dark because they're just learning to write. We have so little information. But the great philosopher of history, R.G. Collingwood, said, Dark Ages are dark to us, but not to those who were in them. Mm-hmm. Always mm-hmm. remember. Mm-hmm. And the more I have worked on this particular period in ancient Greek history, the more my admiration for people's humanity and capacity in the Dark Ages has grown. Mm. They not only did they produce Homer, but they were the audience, in my view, sitting listening to the whole poem. They got the point far more than a whole lot of scholars have got it since in 19th century Germany. They understood it. Mm. And I almost think it's we who live in the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've gone backwards. Mm-hmm. That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. So a few points here on kind of the language thing. So you can expand upon it a little bit. The Homeric Greek, I thought that was interesting because you talk about these Ionic and Aeolic dialects of Greek that were the original forebears of the poem. So you can talk about that. But also this idea, we can kind of get to it now, about the composition, right? So there's debate about whether Homer was singing the Iliad, the use of melodic phrasing and musical invention, whether it was composed orally or not. And then this central thing of, you make the argument that he was illiterate, that he couldn't read, he was not literate. So you just talk about those themes about the kind of the language, the oral aspect of it, and his literacy.
Yeah. The first thing to say is I'm the first to know that we don't know the answer. We have to infer it from a spectrum of possibilities and probabilities. Yeah. So I'm not alone, but I think I'm possibly slightly unfashionable at the moment. It's so hard to know. Mm. People who write scholarly articles are writing them because they have a new point of view. They're not representative. And frequently, wonderfully, like me, they're wrong. So we can't judge it by the quantity of scholarly output. The first point I would want to make is my Homer is not just performing orally. Almost everybody would allow that. He is composing orally in performance. And here I have been strongly influenced by analogy. In the wake of particularly the fine studies of the American Milman Parry in Bosnia in the 1930s, the question of orally composed poetry has become a major worldwide subject of study. And there are examples of illiterate composers composing at length. Now, I was very struck by the length of the great poems about Manas, the hero I found in Central Asia. He was known before, but for a long while we only knew it in Russian, which I can't read. The classicist Maurice Baurer could read it. He's the one person who saw this. Now, these people do not have a text, and this is a crucial point. They have not memorized what they are performing. This is such an easy slip for people to make. There's nothing to memorize. Mm. What they have done is they have rehearsed, they practiced these flexible phrases, I think, since the age of 4 or 5. That's when you begin becoming a Manas singer in the Central Asia. Homer, age 6, couldn't read or write. He wasn't going to be sent to primary school, for God's sake. He's far too clever for that. He has this absolutely wonderful array of growing poetic phrases, and he's constantly rehearsing how he's going to express it in general terms. Then he stands up and he performs like some of the great pianists have performed. Now, sometimes that one's open to correction. I don't know. I was always told that the great Errol Garner, you may remember the king of swing, and certainly a lesser known stride pianist, Don Lambert, could not read a word of music. Didn't make any difference. They could construct wonderful variations on a theme. They're utter geniuses. So as a rough analogy, I've suggested that Homer's like them and we are buying the sheet music later. Now, he is composing in performance, and each performance will therefore have been slightly different. So I am not saying there was something that was only the perfect Iliad in his lifetime. But then the really burning question comes, how do we have it if he's only composing it orally?
And which version, the written version that we have, which of, was it just the amalgamation of all those performances or was it a specific one or
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail, as you usually do, here on the head. There is a unity in the plot and a compression of time, a unity of place, and this habit of progressive by drip revelation of where Hector will die, who he will be killed by, which will be the god and the hero, and so on, the same for Achilles, running through the poem. That's not explicable by a whole team of people. So we have one person's work, essentially, minus bits of book two and book 10. Okay. So how do we explain it? Well, I take an older view, which some still champion, but I think it may be a little in retreat at the moment, that it is the version that Homer himself dictated. Mm-hmm. He had literate scribes. I go into the question of the evidence for the early alphabet, that crucial Greek invention. And we can be fairly sure by 780 to 70, alphabetic writing had come in. Of course, the acceptance would be rather patchy. I am ashamed to say that you all have mobile phones, and this is incredibly impressive. You probably have a whole lot of devices I've never heard of, but I still haven't got around to using them. I, at some point, I may. So not everybody can do it. But those who do adopt the new technology become pretty adept at it very quickly.
Yeah.
That's what we've seen in my lifetime. I mean, I'm amazed how fast people would use the mobile phone, the computer, and all of this. Mm-hmm. I think the alphabet was the same story. Now, why would Homer want to bother to dictate a version of his poem? Mm-hmm. And here I have a suggestion of such simplicity, I can't believe it's never been advanced as far as I know. People say, oh, well, some patron paid for it because the poem supports the rule of the aristocrats and the kings. But it doesn't, really. I mean, what does it show? It shows the first king up being completely inept. Mm. And anyway, it isn't that sort of a poem. It's not ideologically driven. It just takes that world for granted. Secondly, they think perhaps Homer knew about the written epic, well, sorry, heroic poems in the Near East. Well, we have no evidence he could read a single word of them. Mm. You've still got to explain why he did it. And my answer is he could see that there was gain to be made from having a written down copy for a very important group, his children. Mm. They could live off it. That's a totally universal human wish. If they controlled the master text of Homer's poem, they could hurry up to outsiders and they'd have a nice little income for the rest of their lives. Mm. That, I think, propelled him. Mm. But when he's doing it, he's composing orally. He's not reading out a text he's got. He's not at all like an actor. Must think of this. He's not even DiCaprio, who's learned, let's say, three lines, to be generous, on a film screen by heart. It's not that at all. Mm. He has no text. He's a director's nightmare. You put him on the screen, and he just comes up with something. Mm. And it is paralleled in what we can study all around the world now people know more about it. Very clear. Again, good to go to Central Asia. It's only one of several examples. The Russian speakers came out, imagine these valiant people, into Central Asia, and they took down, in dictation, what they were hearing in a dialect was only partly familiar to them. And they took down 4,000 or 5,000 lines in the 1860s. And that was across a language barrier with the poem, the poet dictating. And the famous case is, of course, Milman Parry, very meticulous American, and Albert Lord. And they did it from very elderly poets who were struggling. They couldn't keep going for long enough. They were, you know, already 75, 80. Mm. Well, Homer's dictating to people he wants to dictate. One, he hasn't been paid by Parry. He wants to do it. Two, he's dictating to people in his own language. And either they are his loyal children who think we've got to do it, or they're his slaves who have to do it because otherwise they're for it. And it's not so difficult. Mm. So there were other Iliads, I'm sure, before. Mm. But he then sat down and produced this one. And there is some evidence in some cases elsewhere in the world that when you dictate, you try to do the absolute mega version. You get in everything. this might help with points in book two, where you do think the story of book two is so odd.
Yeah.
You know, Zeus wants to deceive Agamemnon and tell him to attack Troy, even though he isn't going to take it. So what does Agamemnon do? He calls the Greek leaders together and says he's going to test the army by suggesting they should go home. This is all a muddle. But if there'd been two separate versions, one in which Agamemnon did say, why don't we go home, because he was so inept, and another one in which Zeus tested him and said, tell them to attack Troy, knowing deep down they'll all be killed, and Homer's blended them a bit at this point to make, you know, the great dictated version, I can find that easier to understand. And there are many other cases. If you read pedantically, there are little so-called inconsistencies. But if you think of a Homer who is performing and composing as he goes along, they're trivial and they're understandable. He hasn't got time to work over it again. He hasn't gone over it with a barrow in hand or whatever, crossing out things he got wrong when he dictated. He couldn't read it. That was for whoever. I, of course, like to think it was his daughter, but I mean, it's a completely unfounded suggestion. So I think it explains a lot and explains the tremendous engulfing force and speed and direction of the poem. He's got to hold an audience, you know? And that's how he does it. Dante didn't quite have that same need. And that's why some of us can find Dante better in short stretches. I elaborate this at great length in the book. Mm-hmm. And I would say that one of the great Homeric scholars in America, Richard Janko, perhaps one of the greatest experts, still I'm delighted, and also sent me a kind letter saying so, still holds to the dictation theory. And I do. Of course, what he dictated it onto, was it written on skins? Was it written on papyrus?
Papyrus, yeah.
Could they really write? All we've got is three scratch lines on a bad bit of pottery at the time. But that isn't representative. I use an analogy. We know, amazingly, that Dostoevsky dictated some of his novels straight off. He never read a word.
Dictated
them to a poor woman he found, and he then married her. Poor lady. I mean, the guy was completely unreliable, epileptic, and a mad gambler, but she married him. But at the time, if you had only graffiti from Russia, you would say that nobody could possibly have taken down a book as long as Dostoevsky's The Possessed. But we know they did. Do you see? We haven't got the right evidence. It all, my view, just perished. So I have a Homer composing orally as he went along, never memorizing, composing in performance, so it is he who performs, and he gesticulates, varies his voice, and I mean this. I regard him as the first actor in Western knowledge. He's not masked. You know, there's a massive, enormously subtle psychological theory about the relation between the mask and the birth of drama. Well, up to a point. But the first actor wasn't masked. It was Homer, head on, like the singers I listened to in Central Asia. You can see them all still now on Wikipedia. They are engaging directly with their audience. It's thrilling, absolutely thrilling.
It's interesting. I'll just say here that I didn't do it for the Iliad. I did read it recently, but a couple of months ago, I listened to the Odyssey. And I have to say, listening to these poems as opposed to reading them is quite different. Quite different experience. Again, I'm listening to it in English, there is a difference, and you can kind of, you feel it, and there is something very captivating. So you saying all these things here does really drive it home. So I guess the question we haven't really asked here is, which is interesting, right? And I'm sure you have many thoughts on this. You talk about it in the book is, it's a lot of lines of poetry. It's pretty epic. What's the plot? What is the plot of the Iliad? And you can go, I'll give you some runway on this. What's the plot? And how do we look at some of the major themes? We've talked about some of them, but these themes of character and temperament of the figures in these speeches, as we mentioned earlier, you mentioned in the conversation this kind of theory of mind of looking at empathically the other folks in violence and in war. But then also you have a really nice section in the book on shame and guilt. I was very surprised to see that. It was very good, very, very well written. There's a lot of themes that come out that, from here. And there's, you know, what's the kind of driving plot and subplots when we think of that, and then just kind of characters?
Okay. Well, I will take a plunge and say the plot is pretty easy to sum up. And I will preface this by saying that when I first wrote a book, still in print, on Alexander the Great, I tried to overcorrect the proofs, and my publishers were horrified. I'd virtually rewritten the book in the margin. So they locked me up over the weekend in their office, and they told me to cut the corrections by 80%. Mm. So, age 27, 6, I sat in the office, and I did it. I was so bored in the office, I saw that one of the books that Penguin Books were issuing was called A Very Short Anna Karenin by Tolstoy. So I looked at the book, and of course the plot was really, you know, quite amazingly boring. A lady falls in love with cavalry officer, gets pregnant, leaves her husband, and wishes she hadn't, full stop. Mm-hmm. You can boil plots down. The Iliad is rage and wrath at the unjustified loss of his prize, a captive slave girl, causes Achilles in anger to withdraw from the battle. The Greeks suffer, and he sends, dressed in his own armor, his beloved best friend of all. We don't know the relationship was sexual. Homer doesn't want bother to tell us. They might have been. I don't know. They're both of seen sleeping with women in their tents, out into battle, and disobediently, Patroclus goes too far and is killed. And then Achilles sets aside his wrath and engages in revenge for the loss that he has sustained, which is intensified by love. Mm. That's not always mentioned. Doesn't have to be physical love. So those are the main beginning themes. And he engages in terrifying revenge, which is extreme for Homer. And the gods are not happy with it either. But then Homer has a message from Zeus. You must ransom the body of Patroclus' killer, Hector, whom you have killed. And in that point, there is a movement in Achilles from pure revenge to pity. Mm. So these are the themes. From anger through unjust loss of your captive slave girl, to loss of the person you most love in the world, to revenge, and then to pity. Hmm. That's the story. Hmm. As everybody says, there's retardation. There are scenes obviously elaborated, and we know that we never see it. People must realize this isn't a poem about the Trojan War. That's what it's about. Hmm. What an amazing sequence to have picked out and then present in only really 4 hyperactive days over such length. Mm. And it carries us with it. And by the end, when I read it, which I do, I like to take the Greek and translate simultaneously to my undergraduates following in Greek. I can tell you that when we get to the end of book 24, we are all crying. Doesn't matter whether we're 75 or whether they're 20, we're all in tears. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. You know?
Mm-hmm. It's because it's a human... while there's many things going on, you can know that there's these very human elements, these human themes. And for the genius of Homer to the way he tells it, but to tell it in such a honest and explicit way is, you know, tremendous. I mean, it's absolutely tremendous. It's timeless in those ways, which is, you know, many things to discuss here, obviously. But
we have left one crucial thing out.
Please.
The gods.
Yes.
Now, I am firmly of the view that these gods aren't purely poetic creations. And I do emphasize, perhaps more people may not realize than others have done, that one side of the presentation of the gods is that they are super aristocrats written large or composed in grander scale in heaven. They too live in a culture of honor and shame. They too have favorites. They too give to the giver. They have many human ethics But the difference is when the crunch comes, they'll just say, oh dear, in French, c'est dommage, it was a pity, and they will listen to music and turn away because they don't in the end suffer, and they are going to live forever, which is very different to the heroes. Mm. Now, this allows the absolutely crucial quality which I end. If anyone looks at this book, please, whatever I may have done in the first chapters, read the last one. Mm-hmm. I owe to the great critic C.S. Lewis, in passing, a marvelous phrase about Homer and the Iliad, a poem of unwearying splendor, and this is the phrase, ruthless poignancy. He doesn't elaborate, so I did. The ruthless poignancy is an interplay of pathos and absolutely killing irony. We know as readers, because we listen in to what the gods are deciding or what they know will happen. We then return to Earth with a knowledge that the protagonists in the poem don't have. And we see them striving to do their best or their bravest, but we know it's not going to turn out like that. And I suppose Hector's death in book 22 is the place to read most carefully. Ignorant readers think, oh, it was all a cheat. Athena just deceived him. It was horrible. Absolutely no way. That is the hardest irony of all. It's so painful. If I tell it, I'll cry on Zoom. So look it up. Hector believes that one Trojan, his brother, has, after all, come out to help him in the duel against Achilles. Eventually, he stops, having run away in terror. And he throws his first spear. And then Achilles throws his and doesn't kill Hector, who turns to his brother, whom he thinks he's there, and asks for a second spear, thinking, now I've got him. Mm-hmm. But he was nowhere near. Oh.
Yeah. It's
he
it's,
then realizes he's been deceived, and it was only Athena in the disguise of his brother, mm-hmm. and his hour of doom is come. Mm-hmm. Now, we all know the phrase tragic irony. Mm-hmm. It's nothing compared to the hardness of irony in the Iliad, which is quite different to the level of irony in the Odyssey, which is failure to recognize a disused going as a beggar and so on.
Yeah.
But I want to say something firmly. This is not just a trick. This is a deeply held view of the world, and it is still a sustainable view. Maybe people are lucky enough listening and watching. But again and again in my life, I have realized, now I know. I'm not going to describe the circumstances I didn't see at the time. Now I realize. It could be, I'm not giving my own examples, it could be in a relationship with a lover, it could be that you've been trying for years to invest in a dud company. Those are not the things I personally am thinking about. Mm-hmm. But, oh, my God, now I see, now I understand. Mm-hmm. And that is what the Homeric heroes also bring home to us. A sort of phrase that we often say is, I can't watch, it's too awful, mm-hmm. when we're trying to put into words something that's really upset us in a film or a play. Mm-hmm. It's there on the grand scale in Homer. Not because he's cynical, absolutely not. Mm. All the traditional epithets and so much have the unwearying splendor that Lewis likes. The morning is always saffron cloaked and child of the mist and so on and so forth. The wine is honey sweet. Everybody's clean in the ideal epithets. Everything's for the best. No, nothing is singled out with an adjective saying it's horrible. You know, you never get the horrible smelly wasp or the stinking pig. They're always seen for the best, but the action belies it because it does in life. It goes wrong. And it goes wrong partly because we go wrong. Why this poem is still a killer. That's why when I read it, it's not just that it's beautiful, but that unspoken, linked by ruthless poignancy and this deadly irony, far more than in any other of the great Greek tragedies, the audience, even at the age of 20, end up in tears. Try book six.
You're giving a taste for people that haven't read it or haven't read it in a while of again, this it has this enduring power through all of literature and through all of time of understanding the human spirit and the human condition, which is what makes it so wonderful. Robin, this has been so much fun. Time with you goes so quickly. I really have enjoyed our conversation. Really enjoyed it. People should pick out the book, Homer and His Iliad. It's out through Basic Books. It's out now. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to end with something that's very important to me.
Please.
Homer is a genius. I think, some do too, he is the person who invented epic, a poem with a directed plot. It is he who invented a plot, a single plot in a work. And I can certainly say he's the first attestation of robots. Hephaestus has robots. Mm-hmm. Artificial intelligence. He's already imagined that they can apparently speak and think. And in Achilles' shield, he, for the first time, gives us moving pictures. Mm. Blimey. Mm. Oh. Mm. You know, there's no other, not even Shakespeare, has got the same range of potentiality to him. I think Homer would have been a superb film director. Mm-hmm. But it would have been a waste of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot. Well, thank you so much, Robin. This was such a delight. I really enjoyed the book and enjoyed this conversation. So big thanks.
Well, it was only a delight to me because you ask such extremely shrewd questions. You are a real lover of Homer. When you get two together, you can go on for days. We've hardly begun.
That's right.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, love it. Bye.